The Sports Crib Podcast, episode 365. What skill sets do you need to work in women's football? Hello, Sports Achiever, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Sports Crib Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bowers. As always, my goal each week is to provide you a special guest who's an expert in a particular sector of the sports industry, especially if you have an interest in pursuing a career in the women's football industry. I really do hope that today's episode can support your sports career development, interests, and needs. Now, getting back to today's podcast special guest, it's such a joy to have Rachel Pavlou, who is the FA Women's Development Manager in Diversity and Inclusion, where she has over 25 years of experience developing the women's game in England. For that reason, it's such a privilege to have her on the show. And that's why in today's episode, Rachel will share her football career journey and explain to you what skill sets you need to pursue a career in the women's football industry. Have a listen and enjoy. Rachel, it's such a joy to have you on the Sports Career Podcast and a privilege to do another interview with you, by the way. But please, you share to listeners your football career journey. When did it all start?
Hi, Ed. Lovely, Ed. So nice to see you again and do a one-on-one, which is great. So I loved PE. I loved playing sport. It was all at school and out of school in after-school clubs. Just loved it. Knew from how much I admired and had my PE teacher as a role model that I wanted to do something in sport. Thought I'd be a PE teacher because of how much I kind of thought that was my route. That was all I could do. And ended up going to university and not doing a teaching certificate. Ended up going and doing recreation management because one of my neighbours who works in education said, well, look, if you can't make a decision, go and do 3 years in sports development and then do a year's PGCE. And that's why I went to do a 3 year sports development, but then I fell in love with sports development and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So that was it really. School and university, my education, formative years, I just knew I wanted to work in sports. So that's how it got me into working in sports development.
Okay, we're gonna dig deep a little bit because I can relate to my journey. When I was playing sport and PE was my role at the beginning because I could see it and believe it with the role. I didn't know what other roles were out there, to be honest, but I knew when I did my degree at Durham doing sport exercise and physical activity, it opened up different topics and interests. When you were doing your recreational management and the sport degree you were doing, did it open up interests that you weren't aware before that PE teacher sort of inspiration? I'm just curious.
Yeah, what happened for me, which was really interesting, was that three of the main members of staff on the degree course were women. And I didn't expect that. I thought they'd just be men because, you know, you just see men kind of were in every part of sports. And they used to talk about, you know, what they had aspirations for when they were coming through university. And to see that they could become, that I could become like them, be involved in sports development, working in the leisure industry, in the rec industry, work to help sports. I just didn't get it. I just thought you were either a coach or a PE teacher. I didn't think there was other things really. I didn't really understand the landscape. I was very young. Like, you know, I think when you go to university, I was 18 like most people, and I just didn't really know what was out there. I just knew I wanted to work in sport. So they opened my eyes to sports development, and I absolutely fell in love with the opportunity to, and it sounds corny, but change people's lives through sport. I just knew that's what I wanted to do because I knew there were so many barriers for me to play sport, especially in football, and I didn't want that to happen to other girls as they grew up in my lifetime. So to know that I couldn't exceed in the sport that I wanted to on the pitch, but potentially could help others off the pitch, it was kind of really exciting. So I just knew that that's what I wanted to do.
And just one more point, because this is important, and I think it relates so well to this whole conversation, but how important is that seeing is believing mentality of opportunities, not just for playing football, but even career standpoint, because you've had a phenomenal journey. We'll dig deep a bit more detail, but I just want to talk about the seeing, believing aspect and your, you know, viewpoint on that point.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's because, you know, it happened to me. So it happened to me at school. It happened to me at university. It happened to me when I was playing sport. My hero when I was 9 was Chris Evert, because I wanted to be a tennis player because I couldn't be a footballer. So it was like, okay, can't be a footballer, be a tennis player. Then I got into hockey, so I wanted to be like Jane Sixsmith. You know, there was always somebody that was an inspiration to me. So it had to be that way. And I suppose now it's helped me massively with the job, because when I ever do anything with underrepresented communities, I always try and take people with me that those women or girls will find relatable, because it won't be me, you know, that it will be someone in their local community or someone they've heard of. And I want to, and I try very hard to take people with me on my trips and visits, so that, you know, every young girl gets someone that they go, wow, I didn't realize this person did that. And it doesn't have to be a superstar. You know, it could just be somebody in the local community that has had the same life experiences and understanding of that community and what they've gone through and what they're going through, and just could be relatable. And so, yeah, I get it 100%. It really is important.
And let's move forward, because I'm curious about 1998. Like, when did you actually get, you know, the opportunity with the FA role? Just paint the picture, and then we'll go forward of what you've been doing behind the scenes in the women's game. But I just want to experience the moment when you got that opportunity, if you can remember.
The 1998. Well, I had been working at Solihull College as a sports development officer for 4 or 5 years, and I was trying to get through as many different sports qualifications as possible, because I wanted to enhance the girls that I work with, their opportunities, because I work with 16 to 19 year olds. So I wanted to get as many sports qualifications on the pitch as possible. So I ended up going on my football one and met a guy called Tom Stack from Birmingham FA. And he was like, brilliant. And he just said, would you like to volunteer in women's football? And I was like, what do you mean volunteer? Is there any women's football going on in this country? And he was going, yeah, there is. Just very few people know about it. So, you know, you've got to see it. You've got to see what's going on. So he said, would you like to volunteer? I said, oh, I'd love to. It'd be brilliant. So he said, I want to introduce you to Donna McIver at the FA, who works for Kelly Simmons and is looking for volunteers, and we need a Birmingham volunteer. So we need somebody to help in this area. He said, we're one of the biggest county FAs in the country, so it's going to be a big job. So I was like, oh, I said, I'm not sure if I can give lots of time. I'm very busy at Solihull College. I've got lots of sports teams that I run and lots of work I'm doing. But okay, I'll ask the people at my college if that's okay. I was very lucky. I had a principal called Colin Flint, another important man, a male ally, a man in my life who was very important to me, because he really supported me. And he was like, absolutely, do you volunteer for the FA? And, you know, do some football, women's football programs here at the college, do some in the local schools around here. You've got my support. So I agreed to be the volunteer, and I was volunteering for about 18 months. Also doing some stuff with Kelly nationally. She was asking me to do a few things because she knew I liked to run events. So I got to run some events for her, ran the National Fives, which was our only big championships in women's football that the FA ran. And so that was a five-a-side tournament, Aston Villa every year. People like Kelly Smith played in it for Wembley, her local club, you know what I mean? It was like really, really amazing that I got to run things like that. So when the job came out in 98, it was for the regional director of women's football for the FA, North West and West Midlands. And I was like, oh my goodness, I've got to apply for this. It's like my dream job. So I applied for it. Kelly was on the interview panel with the HR team at the FA. And yeah, I got the job. So I was absolutely delighted. It was just brilliant that I had the opportunity to work full time in the game I was so passionate about from such a young age, and always wanted to, you know, play at a high level, but never got the chance to. So this was my chance to change things slightly. So yeah, got to work at the FA. It was the best thing ever.
Time out. I've got to do a time out beforehand about the power of volunteering. Like, I hope people are really listening there. You know, for me, like you said, you took the opportunity with both hands. And, you know, people say volunteer, but from the skills you were doing beforehand with the qualifications, how did it support you with then getting your dream job? I'm just curious.
With everything, because when you volunteer, you start to really understand what you have to do in any job. You know, you have to communicate with people. You've got to work as a team. You've got to be organised. You know, all the things that you need, and you know, they are sort of things that you need in your career. I was doing as a volunteer, and I was getting to know people and understand where they were coming from in the game. And when the interview happens, I was able to draw on all of those experiences in volunteering, as well as all of my past work in sports development at the college. And in my course and all the other things I was able to draw on to be able to show examples of why I wanted them to think I was the best person for the job. So without that volunteering, I wouldn't have got that job. No way. The networking that I had with other women across the country by volunteering in women's football at that time was just brilliant. The FA agreed that they would have one volunteer in every single county because we didn't have a workforce. So apart from Kelly and Donna and a couple of others that were employed by the FA, the workforce was all volunteers, and they had one volunteer in every county, and I was the Birmingham one, as I said. And I got to meet all of those guys as well and learn from their experiences and see that their lives were exactly the same as mine. Wanted to play, played a little, didn't get chances to develop it because we weren't supposed to, so went on and did other things. And when I saw that so many women had that same pathway as I did, it was exciting because I was like, well, look at us as a movement, look what we can do together now to change it. And then to have the opportunity to be that regional director and take all those volunteers and do things with them was just brilliant. And as a volunteer, I could relate to those people that I was working with every day because I'd done that as well. So,
how important is that, the relatability of soft skills during that period? Before we talk about the dream role afterwards, we can dig deep of some of the work you're doing with Kelly. But I just want to emphasize the point that part of the journey is the relatability of communication, and you're sort of all growing together. And I just would love to hear this side of things as well from a skill set perspective.
It really brings people together because when you have the same journeys, you understand where people come from, and then you can really try and work on how you're going to sort of develop things from that. And I vividly remember before I got the job at the FA, those volunteers were offered the very first UEFA B course for women in this country. We were offered the opportunity to apply for it. And quite a lot of us got on it. It was at West Riding FA, and it was in the Easter of 1998, so it was before I even got the job. And on that course was Hope Powell, Sean Williams, and then all of these guys from the county FA. So we were like, oh my goodness, we're totally out of our depth. There's two England players on this course. But when we all sat down and talked in the networking time and of the evenings, it was so obvious. Everyone had had that similar journey and similar frustrations about the game and where we wanted to see change, apart from probably Hope and Sean, who had obviously had the opportunity to play for England. So they'd gone that little bit further than we had. But they also understood the journey. They understood the hardships. You know, they'd all played for no money. They'd all played having to juggle another job at the same time of playing the game. So that was really amazing. And I'll tell you a story that I've told a few people, and some people, the listeners, might have heard this, but this is one of my favourite stories. I received a letter after that course, and it said, you have been successful in your application to be a regional director for the FA. Hope Powell also got a letter that same week saying, you have been successful as the future England women's national manager. And I always say to Hope, which she hates me saying it because she thinks I'm an idiot, but I always say, you do know they got the letters mixed up because I was far the better candidate on the UEFA B than you were. And I, I stick with that. Not really. She was, of course, brilliant. But I stick with that story because I just think it's really funny and it makes her laugh every time and just shake her head. But it was just such a wonderful experience of being on that that course with everybody that was in the volunteer capacities and see how relatable we all were. And then I knew then that the football, I call it the women's football family, the family would always work to make the game better, despite all the obstacles and frustrations that we all had to encounter.
We will talk about the barriers. I think it's really important because I feel like we always forget barrier is, and we know what it means when we talk about it. But at that period of time, what were the barriers? Was it the access standpoint of just equal opportunity? Was it having the pathways, which we will dive into because that's what Kelly shared when she just got her role? Could you just paint the picture at that current time, 1998? What were the key barriers, which I hope are more addressed now or developing? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. I think it's important.
We had every barrier you could possibly imagine. We had no resources. You know, we had the people. So there was Hope as manager, Brent as assistant manager, Helen Nicolau who ran. So she ran and did the logistics. Lois who did the youth teams. So that was England. And then there was Tessa who ran the league. Me, Kelly, Donna McIver, Lucy Wellings, Ros Potts, and Julie Lewis as regional managers. And that was it. So in the whole country, that they were the only people employed to work in women's football full-time. Claire Wheatley was at Arsenal as the first full-time person in women's football at Arsenal. And that was it. No one else was paid to be full-time. So we relied massively on the volunteer network in the women's game. And they were all very passionate, but they didn't have the time to be able to invest in the work that we needed to do and the escalation that we needed to happen so quickly. So that was hard. So relying on volunteers and not having resources, we didn't have any money, or we were given a small budget to support the game. But, you know, the budget really wasn't there. We had to try and find other funders to help us to get the money in to help us. As we know now, still facilities were a real problem. The men were playing all weekend, so the women only got a Sunday afternoon, and it was the last game of the weekend, which meant that usually it was cancelled because the pitch was gone. It was either waterlogged or it had been massively overused. So a lot of the games were cancelled, so we didn't have the facilities that we needed. We didn't have the buy-in from many people. Most people didn't want women's football to happen. They felt it was taking money out of the men's game. It wasn't important. It wasn't needed. Women could play netball and hockey. They didn't need football. So there was all that kind of like issues around what people thought about the game. Equal opportunity wasn't even discussed in schools. You know, they didn't play football at school. So that was the end of that for women and girls. We didn't have a pathway. That was only just coming in. Like Kelly had set up the Centres of Excellence in 98 when that had just come in. And that was exciting because we actually had a possibility of something special that the FA were prepared to fund. But the pathway otherwise was very small. Hope was doing everything in terms of England and talent, and was such a massive job to look after the England women's team, but everything else as well. It was just one of those things where you came and you thought, how are we ever going to do this job and where are we going to start? And I think a lot of people, when we came in as a team, first of all, there was a little bit of negativity around you're being paid, we're volunteers, so you can do it all. And we were like, well, we can't do it without you all because we're just a handful of women. And then there was, what are we actually going to focus on? Because everybody wanted us to do everything straight away. And we just knew that was never going to be the case. It was impossible to be able to do everything. So, yeah, there's a lot of barriers, but there was an immense amount of passion. There was an immense amount of happiness and joy at being able to work together with the same aims of what we wanted to achieve. We had a lot of fun. We've got lots of great stories as a team of what happened at the beginning and what we were doing and all the things all the funny stories of it. Because we literally got involved in absolutely everything, even looking after the teams that came to play England. We looked after those teams that came from abroad to make sure they were okay and take them to the games in transport and make sure they got equipment and kit and hotels and everything. We did everything and it was just brilliant. But it was just, it took 24/7, you know, it really was. Every part of our time was spent working, and I don't regret it for one moment because it was brilliant, but gosh, it was hard.
Wow, okay. How do I decode this? Because I had Kelly on. You must listen to that podcast. I'm getting from her perspective. I want to take a positive from this, because the one thing Kelly said to me, said when she just got our role and she went with her father for our interview process, and the father just wanted the experience of going to the main headquarters, she said that the good thing she did have was a blank canvas, which then set up the different policies and literally building it from scratch. In a way, could you say that is the positive from that period to where the game is now, then modelling, you know, just everything from the men's game? Because Kelly said she literally could have the freedom to find best practices from different departments, learn just good practice in general. So I just want to hear your thoughts on the blank canvas standpoint to where the game is in England football right now. Would love to hear your thoughts on that side of things, despite it was 24/7 job.
Yeah, it was exciting because we could learn from men's football. We could learn from other sports, particularly netball and hockey, in the way that developed. Women's cricket, women's rugby wasn't really being talked about at that time. So we didn't really have any sports that were being dominated by men, because hockey was pretty much 50-50 and was mainly a women's sport for a long time before it became a joint sport. So we didn't really have anything to go from there. We also talked to a lot of countries abroad about what they were doing. So all that was really exciting, to sort of take the very best practice from everybody and then work out what was going to be good for us. And maybe it was trial and error. Some things didn't work, some things did. But yeah, it was the whole thing was exciting. It still is. I mean, this is what I say to people. I can't believe that for 25 and a half years, I have loved what I've done. And I still love it. And I still can't wait to get up the next day to find out what we're going to be doing next, with the emails that come in, with the opportunities that happen. You know, I love what we do. And I don't think there's many people that can say from the very first moment they started to the day that is still there, 25 years later, they're as happy as they were. Even though we're in different times now, there's different reasons why I'm excited and happy for the reasons that I was originally then. And you know, people say, what are things that you look back on and are so excited about? And I always say, I've been part of a sports journey from zero to hero. I always say that. I know I do, but it's true. We were not anything. You know, all those people who worked beforehand to develop women's football, you know, in the time of the ban in the 70s with the Women's FA, and they all did that. And then we came in and we were given money to work on it. And I look at it, I just think, yeah, but it's still zero even then. Even when we came in, it was still zero. It was still zero for many years that we were at the FA. No one bothered about it. And then all of a sudden, that momentum started to happen over a series of years of things that happened. Really key catalyst moments happened, and the game started to go on and on. And I just feel like, wow, I've been there when it all started to really change, and people were paid to get involved in the game for the first time. And I'm really proud.
Just with a milestone, would you say that bronze medal in Canada?
For me personally, it was before that. It was 2005 when we hosted the Women's Euros. It was 2007 when we went to the World Cup in China. 2009 when we got a silver medal in Finland in the Euros. 2012 with the Olympics, then the Super League, then 2015 when we won the bronze medal at the World Cup. That journey, there was something that happened every few years that was like, that's it. But it never really kicked on as much as I was hoping it would do until Kelly and Martin Glenn brought in Sue Campbell. And then when Sue came in, the three of them and their vision for how we could take the game forward, that's when it went. With all those things that happened, it kind of went, right, we're taking all of that, all of the stuff that went on pre-FA, with the Women's FA and the ban, we're going to take all of that now and we're going to make it into where it is now. And that's when another major seismic thing happened for Miss Football, with Sue coming in and both Martin and Kelly realising that it wasn't going to do anything unless we brought in someone who could help us to do that.
Amazing. Can we do a cool case study where we can compare 2005, which there were only 8 teams in the Euros in England, to the 2022 Euros, which had twice as many teams in, so the listener can get a better understanding of the growth of the sport, particularly from a competition standpoint?
So you're absolutely right. Only 8 teams in 2005. We only did it in one region of the country. We did it in the Northwest. I believe it was the first time ever that a legacy plan was ever written for a major women's football tournament. So we had a consultancy come in and do that for us. And we worked over 2 hotels where we had 4 teams in one hotel and 4 teams in the other hotel. And we basically ran everything from there. And I know you've interviewed Tatiana from who worked at UEFA at the time many times. She was the person in charge of the venue, and I was her assistant. And that was the first time I'd ever worked with anybody internationally. It was absolutely brilliant. We had such fun. by working 24/7 to make that tournament a success. And it was so special for lots of reasons. One, it was the first time I ever remember men and boys wearing women's footballers' names on the back of their shirts. It was the first time I remember being in a stadium that had over 20,000 people. I could never experience that to watch women's football before. And it was the first time that I saw England win games and people talk about it, because everyone who remembers then will remember Karen Carney scoring in the last minute against Finland, and the euphoria of the city of Manchester Stadium erupts when that happened. You know, that was one of the most wow moments that I remember at that time. But it was such a special time, but we didn't get out of the group. We just didn't progress. It was a big thing for us to even be part of that tournament. We were really in that developmental stage. So I remember it being very, very special. I remember people talking about it, but then literally the tournament finished and everybody stopped talking about it, and that was it. And then you come to 2022 and there are 9 host cities, 5 different regions of the country, truly national legacy plan, local plans, local groups, everybody excited about the fact we're hosting the Euros, people coming from everywhere to want to watch the games, all being sold out. You know, it was just chalk and cheese. And then obviously you have the added bonus of being part of a tournament where England won for the first time, where they not only won, but they played at Wembley to the biggest crowd ever for a Euros, both men's and women's. They beat Germany in our own country to lift the Euros. So you kind of had all these amazing legacy things happening and fantastic plans, and then we went and won it. So that kind of thing meant that after that tournament, it hasn't stopped developing. It hasn't stopped being escalated. It hasn't stopped being magnificent and brilliant. Whereas 2005, it might have been great for the 2 weeks we hosted it, but then it all went quiet and no one ever remembered we did it. Until obviously we put the application in this time for the 2022, because we talked about 2005 and we talked about how the legacy plan started and was really exciting, but we had no one to do anything with it. And that's what we wanted to change this time, was to say it can't just be a legacy plan that is just leads up to the tournament and then finishes on the day that the last game finishes. It has to be a legacy plan that goes on and on and on, and it has to have resources to keep supporting it. And that's been the difference with this one as well, is that we've had resources to continue the legacy plan onwards. So yeah.
We'll talk about legacy plan, but I want to go back to 2007, because as I said to you before, I said I read Alex Scott's book, was just brilliant. You must read it, everybody, from different perspectives. But for me, there was this little chunk about how significant Get to China was, because they just qualified. And then there's this little piece about Rachel coming up with this mascot sort of tradition that really brought the team together. And I just want to actually hear your thoughts of going to China for a World Cup experience as well, from your perspective, Rachel.
Yeah, China was amazing. So I'd worked on 2005, got to know Hope really well and the team, because, you know, supporting them in that tournament. And Hope said, would you come to China and help us? Just an extra pair of hands, really need your support. You know, this is massive. And we had so few staff anyway. So I asked if I could. It was agreed I could go out there. And basically, I was prepared to do anything to support the team, which is what I did, not just in 2007, but I then worked on 9, 11 and 12 and 13 as well. So I worked on those major tournaments with Hope. So we did. We ended up working together a long time with the England girls doing stuff. So when I was out there, I was asked to do things like support friends and family to make sure that they're safe and well, and we know where they are, give them tickets, give them food and drink, make sure that they're supported. That was my major role. But the other thing was to sort of like, I wanted to be kind of part of the team and be involved with what, you know, the team were doing. And one of our colleagues, Pippa Bennett, had brought a panda out with her, a cuddly panda. And we'd had this conversation about it. Could it be, you know, should we make it our mascot? So this is Yolanda the panda. Yolanda the panda, I don't know whether you can actually, she's got a little tag. It says, Amanda the Panda, address FA Soho Square. It's got our telephone number on it. So she's got her own little lanyard with a FIFA.com. This is the original Yolanda the Panda. She has an England kit on. So Yolanda the Panda became our first mascot, and she went everywhere. You actually can find photographs of her on the top of the dugout in China at the most matches and at the thing. Anyway, so this became a tradition. So this is Yolanda the Panda. Then we went to Finland. This is Bruce the Moose with accreditation lanyard and obviously England top. That's Bruce the Moose. Then, so that was 9. Then 11, we went to Germany, and Hope Powell has Cher the Hare. I didn't get to keep Cher the Hare. Then we went to the Olympics. This is Brian the Lion. And then we went to Sweden, and this is Trusty the Husky. So what had to happen is I had to go and find the mascot beforehand, and the agreement always was that I would find it, and he had to have a reason, a rationale. So I'd always look up the animals that belonged to the country that we were going and the attributes and characteristics of that animal, and did it relate anything to the lionesses and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't just I went to the shop and bought it. I really, really thought about it. And then I brought it to the tournament. We had a little launch party on the nights before we started the games, and the girls had to name the mascot. So that was their decision. They named the mascots. I just had to bring it and come up with why I'd chosen it. So I'd always do this little presentation about why I'd chosen it. And the younger players only believed that was my job. They just thought my job was to make mascots for the England team. And I didn't do anything else other than help the friends and family while I was there. And for years and years, a lot of the players honestly did not know what I did at the FA. They just thought I was a helper. A mascot helper. Sure, there's the mascot maker. And I always thought it was really funny because I didn't say, oh, by the way, I do actually work full-time at the FA Developing Women's Football, and a lot of the programmes that you got in, I helped make. But I'm just like, no, this is great fun that they think that all my job has ever been is to make mascots. So, yeah, so you've actually now seen all of them apart from Cher the Hare, because Hope will not give me Cher the Hare back, even though I've asked her a million times that it's unfair that Cher is on her own without her mascot family, but she won't give it to me.
Oh, I'm so grateful for that story. For me, this is why I love podcasting, because for me, like I said beforehand, I asked that question. Alex, thank you so much for sharing that in your book. This is what brings a team together. And I think it's the non-football stories that actually make the journey even more special. And honestly, to see your smile as the mascot maker just shows the perspective of what being part of women's football is all about. But I'm going to put you on a bigger question now, because, you know, the thing you said in 2005, you had boys wearing the names of the shirts of the players. When I spoke to Kelly, I said, out of interest, when was the biggest cultural shift? Because that's the hardest part in anything society is to change at. Would you mind sharing your perspective of where it really shifted? Was it the last 5 years with regards to the 2022 Euros from, you know, a globalization standpoint of social media? Or is it just one of those paths that just take time because we are humans? I'm just curious from that side of things. I think it's really important as well.
I do think all of those moments that I said to you were really important. And I'll always go back to the ban, and I'll always go back to I'll never forget where we've come from, because I think it's really important. But I do think 2012, the Olympics in Great Britain, was really very important, because it didn't just change women's football, it changed women in sport, because it was a time when women were becoming about 50-50 in terms of how many women were participating in events. It was a time when the broadcasters wanted to show women's sports as much as they wanted to show men's sport. It was a time when, because of all this happening, women's rugby and women's cricket were doing really well. So other men's dominated sports were doing well. We were becoming a sport that people were getting to like and respect. And we had some players that were now becoming household names, and the Olympics escalated that. Broadcast partners and commercial partners wanted to have conversations with us. I just saw, oh, and of course, the 70-odd thousand that were in Wembley Stadium to see that Brazil game. It started to feel that, the Olympics made a massive difference culturally of women in sport, which helped women in football. I just thought that that was massive for the whole of women in sport. And then it really helped us with the Super League, because that was around that time as well. It helped us to get people to come and watch that and invest in that, and broadcasters to want to show that as a legacy from the Olympics. So there's lots of moments that I could say, but I kind of feel the Olympics was the one for me.
I'm going to give you a real life example. I used my pocket money and I took my mother to the Japan-France game at the Olympics. And it was her first time to modern Wembley because they used that venue. And it was a phenomenal experience. And I think, you know, you just sparked it while you're talking about, and again, it's that change of mentality, which I think is really, really important. And just going back to the word legacy again, because firstly, you've got to listen to it on YouTube, the Athens Women's Football Summit. We go in depth, Rachel and myself, on the power of a legacy. And honestly, all the content's there. But just curiosity, from 2005, which you said it was the first legacy program you sort of built within that tournament, you know, from that experience and then the legacy program of 2022, how has it had an influential part of implementing a legacy program from that side of things, reflecting?
Hosting a tournament, for me, is one of the big things that any country can do to escalate their game. We made the decision in 2022 that we would use our women's football strategy that was already written and just, and I'll use that word again, just escalate it. So going to each of the host cities and put more resources and more investment where we know fans are going to come to and see if it made a difference. And absolutely did it make a difference. It didn't just make a difference for those host cities who benefited. It made a difference for the whole country, because they could take some of the good practice that we were doing in the host cities and then use it in their areas as well. So I always felt that after 2005, if we'd have only had the resources to continue after the tournament, things would have been different. But we started it really excitingly with that plan, but then couldn't do anything with it. And I think some of the countries have found that as well. It all goes on those 2 or 3 weeks. It's all amazing. There's work just before it. And then everyone goes, oh, great, we've finished the tournament. We can all go to sleep now and have a break because it's been mad. And then no one does anything else on that particular legacy plan. So by us having the strategy as the major part of our legacy plan meant that it would continue past the tournament, because our strategy was to 2024. So we're still implementing all that work that we've even started before the Euros. And we were, I suppose, in a way, it was fortuitous that our strategy was 2020 to 2024, because it was right bang in the middle of the Euros. So we could start all the work, we could carry on all the work. So any kind of country that looks at this, the feeling back to them always is just make sure you don't just finish it on the day the tournament ends. You know, you have to keep it going. And that momentum means that, you know, people then will talk about it far past whether you win the tournament or you go out in that first stages. And we always felt that 2005 was a missed opportunity, that we were ready for it as the few staff that were there and the volunteers desperately wanted it, but there was just not the investment at that point to do anything more than host it.
And just one thing, we've spoken about everything on the pitch. When was the moment, and we can relate to the 2022 with like 2.4 million women and girls playing in participation, like recreational football. When was the moment in your role going, hold on a minute, yes, the game, you know, the professional side's growing, but we cannot forget the grassroots, not just from a pathway standpoint to be professional football players, just participating to be healthy human beings. When was that moment where this was an important factor, not just the legacy program, but growing the women's game?
Without doubt, grassroots football is the most important part of this game, because if you didn't do the grassroots, it just wouldn't have grown to the way that it is. And, you know, I think some countries, they will invest everything into their senior team. And then when that senior team gets to an age where they just find, oh, we haven't got anybody to backfill them with because we've put all our money into the senior team and that particular current team. What we always tried to do, which sometimes was complicated, was that we wanted to invest in grassroots, talent, the England team and workforce. And they were our four major things that we needed to do. And grassroots included schools and clubs. They were the two big things. So we always said that you couldn't have a full proper women's football sport without the whole, without that as your key areas to work on. So grassroots has always been the most important in my eyes, because it has to be the area that inspires the next generation to get involved and play, and then hopefully they'll be the ones that eventually take over not just the team but also all of our roles, all of the jobs that are out there in the women's football. It has such a major part to play. So yeah, that there is no more important area in my opinion than grassroots, my perspective on it.
But just on a pride standpoint, when I said 2.4 million are now playing, you know, girls and women, like, how does that fulfill you than just what goes on the pitch, you know? Because I just want to hear your thoughts on that, because I think it's a really important thing to highlight and to address as well.
There's two things there. One is how many are playing, but the other thing is how many people are volunteering, working in the game now. Because looking back, if you remember when I first started this conversation with you, there was a handful of people in this country paid to work in women's football. Now, if you look up everybody that could get a job in women's football, not just on the pitch but off the pitch, it is an industry. And probably that is what makes me the proudest out of the whole thing about how many girls are playing and how many women are playing. It's the infrastructure around it in terms of the women and girls that can work in the game, because all those young girls not only know that if they can play it and they can get to the best level if they want to, but if they don't and they love it so much like I did, you can work in it and you can be paid to work in it. And that is just pretty unbelievable, really. I never thought I'd ever be able to be paid to work in it, in the sport that I loved. But now there are so many opportunities. It's just unbelievable. So I think actually I'd turn it around and say, yeah, that's great. And I'm very proud, but it's the workforce and it's the support of that workforce and the development of that workforce that I'm probably the most proudest of when it comes to the grassroots and where we are today.
I'm going to put you on the spot, but it's a personal question working with Kelly, because I said the same thing to her on the podcast with her. What did you learn the most working with her over that period of time? You know, just from a leader standpoint in particular.
I could talk for ages about what I learned from Kelly, for sure. But I think the one thing that sticks in my mind more than anything is she taught me how to work within the FA infrastructure. So I had absolutely no idea about how important the governance of the game was in terms of the council members, the county football associations. I didn't understand the way that that all worked. And what Kelly explained and showed me and gave me experience of was that you work with them and you influence them and you help them to see that this is really important to them. She really taught me a lot, and I really felt that that was one, there was lots of things, but that was one of the biggest things that I had no idea what to do. And I learned so much from her, and knew how to be a politicker, as I often said to her, thank you for making me a politicker, because I kind of get it now. I understand what we have to do to bring everybody along with you. But I got the understanding that actually, if you did, you could get more for the game going forward. And that was what was really important.
I want to talk about one little case, because it was also at Athens, and Kelly mentioned it, about being resilient, where you were both outside your office when one of the deals fell through. And I said in the moment, I was like, Kelly, that it's all well saying, you know, dust yourself off, get back in the office. But she said, we were both petrified getting back in the office and where to go from there. But in that actual moment, how did you get that resilience or self-confidence, if there was any, to just keep going forward? I know that's easy said than done. And this body language is unbelievable, what I'm seeing from Rachel. But I think it just puts things in perspective again.
That was the Women's Super League. It sent out all of the prospectuses to all of the chairs and chief executives of every single men's club in England, plus the universities, this beautiful glossy brochure of, this is the next steps of women's football. We want to invest in it. We're going in the right direction. You are our stakeholders. Please apply for one of the licenses to join the Women's Super League, and please invest in it if you're a funder or a commercial partner. And it was brilliant. The prospectus was just out of this world. It was more than I'd ever seen before. I was just, couldn't believe we'd brought it together. It was brilliant. The day after that brochure went in the post, I was on the train coming to Soho Square to have the meeting on, right, we've done it, now let's talk about how we're going to implement this and get our little panel together for the interviews. And I opened the page onto the back pages, and in a very small section of the back pages, it says, the Women's Super League has been put on hold by the FA. And I just looked at it and I read it again and I read it again. I thought, no, that's not right, because someone would have told us, right? We wouldn't have sent the prospectuses out yesterday. But everybody knew we were sending them out. So, no, that's not right. So I was on the train, so I couldn't speak to anybody because it was so confidential. So I was literally texting. There wasn't such a thing as WhatsApp then. So I was texting everybody, like, have you read in the papers about this? It can't be right. It can't be right. And I got this message from Kelly to say, when you get into the office, you need to come and see me. And I was like, oh, gosh, no, what's happened? I couldn't wait to go in the office. So I phoned her when I got off the train. I said, what's happened? And she said, the board had made the decision to put the Women's Super League on hold. And I just couldn't get my breath. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that had happened. And I remember walking into the office and just sitting at my desk, and no one was there, like people were in meetings. And I just put my head on my arms, and Kelly walked in seeing me with my head on my arms. And she said, Pav, you've got to get your head off your arms. You've got to move on. People are going to come in the office now and see you. We've got to be the ones that are the strong ones on this. And I went, Kelly, I can't. So I can't do it. So I've given everything to make this WSL happen. It was never part of any of our job descriptions. We were a small group of women who did this in our spare time at the FA. And I say that, it's true. We were working extra hours that we didn't even have to make this happen. And I couldn't even bear the thought of telling all those people that this has happened. I couldn't bear telling the volunteers out there that had invested in putting all their time together to apply. I just couldn't bear the thought of all what was going to happen. And I couldn't get my head off my hands. And I really felt that there's only been a few times that I was going to leave, and that was the one that I was going, because I thought, I can't do this. I can't get, you know, that was 2010. So I'd been working there 12 years and I'd given everything for 12 years. And I thought, I obviously can't do this. This is just can't do it. So that was the worst time. And how we went on from there just does show the resilience that we had. It showed the passion that we had, but it also showed that there was no way that people were going to push us down. Like, we represented too many people, too much history, too many things. But there was no way that people were going to stop us achieving what we wanted to. And when the WSL became 10 years a few years ago, I mean, me, Kelly, and some of the other women were messaging each other saying, wow, you know, who would have ever thought that the WSL would be 10 years old, but let alone that, be one of the best leagues in the world for women's professional sport. You know, it was everything. It's now everything we ever wanted and dreamed it to be, but it was so close to never, ever happening. And that day was, yeah, when anybody mentions it, I kind of go, oh, you know, it brings back some really awful memories of where we were with it.
I'm grateful for you sharing that, because like I said at Athens, we just see currently in England the glory moments and this momentum, and we forget of the true hardships. I'm speechless. I don't even know how to reply, because I would probably be the exact same as you, Rachel. And you've done this for decades, and you know, showcasing the players who, like, when I watch the players now, they always talk about the past and how the game, you know, it's like passing the baton. And that's where I'm inspired by you, Kelly, and many people beyond. I don't know how you've done it. I said, I've only got a four-year gig in women's football of the passion of educating on this podcast, but there's times I just, even Tatiana, when we have conversation, I'm going, how do you just do it? Like, it's easy just with words, but with action and drive, I really do admire what you've all done. And I think people who are watching the game now need to learn the educational side of where it is today. But just from a skill set standpoint, I think this is really important. And you can reflect, and we talked about resilience, but what other skills in general for people who work in women's football have really supported you? Even ones you thought were never imaginable, but looking back, have really helped you right now and actually love the work you do, despite the hardships along the way?
Well, resilience would definitely be not in my top three, let alone the fact that teamwork. And isn't it ironic that football is a team game, but it's not just a team game on the pitch, it's a team game off the pitch. So being someone who played hockey, because I couldn't play football, and then obviously played football, though the two sports you need teamwork, and that I brought that with me, and being part of working in collaboration is just fantastic. And that's not just within the FA, that's outside the FA, that's across other countries. And it's interesting because you talked about how you felt talking to Tatiana and Kelly and others. The women's football family, that fraternity is all around the world. You know, wherever you go, you meet people exactly the same. And that's why I believe women's football is where it is because all those, particularly women, but I'm not saying men haven't, because we've got some amazing male allies, but women have really stepped up and realised that if something's going to change, they have to make it change. And it's not just going to happen by us keeping our fingers crossed and hope that the men's game will do it. You know, we've got to be part of it. We've got to help it happen. So definitely teamwork. I've always been someone who's massively organised. Like I love to be organised. I love to plan. So events were a big thing that I used to do because I love to be able to achieve an event at the end, and you have to plan that and you have to organise that. At university, my nickname in the hockey team was the organiser because I do all the socials and I do the press releases and I just do all of that. So organisational skills are definitely brought into working into this environment. And obviously communication. You have to be someone who can talk to people, who can influence people, who can listen. And listening is such a key part of it all, because I never wanted to be someone that people would say, well, she sits in the ivory tower and makes those decisions and it's really rubbish. I always wanted to be someone who said, we see Rachel Pavlo out in the communities and she comes and visits and she listens and she looks at what we're doing and she learns from that. All of the things I've ever done is because I've listened and I've tried to take the good from what is out there already. Because you never really do something from scratch. You're always learning from what's been done before. And I always laugh at this, because if you look at all of the programs that Sport England have done over the years in sports development from years and years and years ago, they actually repeat. they just stop. Something else comes on, which is the new thing. And then a few years later, they repeat something that they did years ago, but they call it something else. And that is sports development, when you just keep doing what you've always done, but you do it better and you learn from it and you make it more shiny. We're always going to do the same kind of things, because at the end of the day, you are talking about schools, clubs, talent, England, workforce. And that's always the same. It's never going to change. You need all of those things to happen, and therefore it's going to repeat itself and repeat itself. So yeah, I think you have to be able to communicate really well to put your point across and to show what you want to achieve. And having that strategy that we talked about so much in Athens on that podcast and in that environment is the key thing that everyone then can focus on. So you put all those communications down in one place. Everyone knows what they've got to do. And it's exciting now at the FA because we're writing our 2024-2028 strategy. And we haven't even finished the one we're on now, but we're writing the new one because we're so ready to do the next stage of women's football evolution. And I can't believe I'm saying this, that I'm excited about that. But I am, because it means everybody knows now, when we had released that in the summer, what the next 4 years look like and what we're hoping to achieve after everything we've achieved so far.
My goodness, I hope people have taken notes and without a doubt listen to the session I did with Rachel on the Legacy Pro. We go in depth, and that's why I'm grateful. And I think that's probably where we connected so with our first ever call, was using education, a tool where other nations around the world can model Legacy Pro. It doesn't have to be a mega competition, everybody. It could be the smallest competition in your area with a 10 to 15 mile radius. You can still impact people in community. I've got this big nodding head on the screen where Rachel agrees, and that's what it's all about. But out of interest, Rachel, like, what have you enjoyed the most from your women's football career journey, looking back right at this moment?
Oh my goodness, you're asking me. What have I enjoyed the most? That has to be the Euros. Has to be the one that most people will say they love women's football. So I think everyone will say that. So I'm not going to say that, because everyone will say that. We've talked about the Women's Super League. So everybody who knows me will know that that was one of my major achievements, of being part of that team that brought that to the table and made that happen. So I'm really excited about that. We've talked about workforce and how important it is to be a mentor and how important it is to support workforce. So we've done that one. So I think the only one we haven't talked about, which is something I'm very, very proud of, is Wildcats, which is the 5 to 11 girls football program. Always wanted to run a 5 to 11 girls only program, because it it was something that I did in 96, 97 at Solihull College as a pilot to work with the FA on it as a volunteer. And I did things of a weekend to run that centre. And Kelly and Donna were the ones that helped me to set that up as FA members of staff and me as the volunteer. And I ran that every single Sunday, this little girls' football centre at Solihull College. And Karen Carney was part of that, which most people are aware. I've just realised that my speakers are still on, so we're just turning them out. We can carry on, we don't need to pause. Karen Carney was part of my centre, along with Sarah Westwood, who is the general manager of Birmingham City Ladies. She was in it as well. And a girl called Holly Aldred, who I saw at the World Cup in Australia for the first time in 20-odd years, who's still involved in women's football today. All these girls used to come to the centre of a Sunday, and the students from Solihull College helped me to run that centre every week. They were my volunteers. I got them through their level ones, and they ran that centre with me. And it was just a beautiful environment for girls only every week. And so many of those girls went on and played for football for their clubs. And obviously Karen went on to play for England. So it was a very, very special project. And when Sue Campbell came into the FA, she wanted to talk to all the staff about where they were, where they wanted to be, what they'd not been able to achieve and why. And I always said, I really wanted to keep that pilot going, but we just didn't have the resources. We all had to decide on what was important at that time. And a 5 to 11-year-old program wasn't when we were running mini soccer for boys and girls. It was felt that that would do at the time. It would get girls playing, so we'd do that. But I was always conscious that a lot of girls didn't want to play with boys and there was something really missing. So being able to talk to Sue about that, and Sue, as most people know, has got the most amazing sports development brain. She saw it and she got it and said, go and pilot it. You know, go and try whatever you want to do with 5 to 11-year-old girls and come back to me. And that's where Wildcats was born. And to be able to sit here today and know that there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of centres across the country that are really starting that journey for young girls who aren't confident to play with boys straight away and need that safe environment and that fun environment with other girls to start the game. And it's gone on from there. And it's now even sponsored by Weetabix. You know, it's all grown up from the little Wildcats project that we first started. So that's possibly, as someone who believes so passionately in grassroots and someone who always believes in sports development, to actually have set up a program with the help of some of my colleagues to where it is today, yeah, that's got to be one of the things I'm most proud of.
Ah, that's such a wonderful answer. Seriously, like the Weetabix and having that sort of involvement's amazing. And I like to finish with an inspirational one, and it's a definition, because for me, it connected me so well with you in Athens because you were wearing the badge. Could you just share to listeners your definition of football for all, and what does that really mean to you?
I feel really strongly about that badge. When the FA agreed to put football for all actually write the words, it was one of those really special times. I was so excited that they did that, because it's what, for me, FA stands for. It's what football stands for. So being able to now work and focus on that area is awesome. And what I believe it stands for is that you look at our country of England, and I just need and want football to be representative of our country. And if it's not, then we have to do things to make it representative. It also has to be the sport that has the, and I believe it's the sport that has the greatest power to make change. It's no coincidence that our strategies have been called over the years inspiring positive change, using football to build a better future. You know, we use all of these strap-lines, changing lives. You know, we use all of these strap-lines because we know that football is for social good. And so, without a doubt, there's so much more work to do in this space to make every young girl in this country feel that women's football is a place for her in whatever area she wants it to be a place, whether it's on the pitch or off the pitch. We've got a lot more work to do. But by working with all the national partners that we have done over the last few years, and everybody focusing on this area, I am seeing, and our colleagues are seeing, that change. I do see change, and I do see an increase in participation in areas of underrepresentation. And I do feel that we're working hard to make our environments more welcoming, and understanding our communities a lot better by working with local people to do that. So, yeah, I think it's better loads more work to do. And without doubt, our next strategy, which we've talked about, 2024 to 2028, will have inclusion and diversity throughout the whole strategy of every area. It won't be a box on its own. It's going to be integrated into everything we do. So every single person who works in football has to think about, is it inclusive? Is it diverse? Is it equal for all girls and women to participate? So, yeah, it's a good time to be really focusing on this area and getting it right and making up for the many years that we haven't got it right.
100%. And what a wonderful answer to finish off. Rachel, how can people interact with you and connect with like the FA social media channels? Like, where are the best places to go for the listeners to follow, engage, but most importantly, learn as well with the growth of the game in England?
Well, and I'm sure most of your listeners are not old like I am and therefore do social media, which is what I don't do. So obviously all of our social channels are great. You know, the FA social channel, the England Football, the FAWSL, the Women's National League, all of our grassroots work, you know, everything is on all of those football channels, as well as all of our key partners that have their own channels as well. So you can always get all the most up-to-date information. If anybody wants to specifically interact with me, I don't do social media, as I said, but there is an email address that you can go to if as a last resort, because I hope that most people know that they have a women's football representative in every single county football association of this country. There is one person that's full-time working in the game that has a brief to support the women's game in their county, and then has lots of other colleagues that does women's football as well to lean on. So you can go to your local county and get support. But if you're really needing that help that you don't feel you get from anywhere else, then women's.football@thefa.com, women's.football@thefa.com is the email address that we pick up if people feel that they've gone everywhere and they're really struggling to get help. And that's the one that our colleagues will read to try and help, because we want to always be accessible to everybody to say, if you can't go through all the channels you've gone through and get the support, we want to try and feel that you can get to us through that email address. So it's still there, it still works. We still check it every week. So anybody that needs additional support, they can connect through that.
Amazing. To all the listeners listening in, that email address and all those links will be on my website with regards to this amazing podcast chat. Rachel, it's been a joy chatting with you again. And thank you so much.
Always lovely to speak to you, Ed. Thank you so much for what you're doing to ensure that women's football is out there, that people are listening about all the major things that are happening. And you're doing a great job of escalating with us. So thank you, Ed, because we can't do things like this without you.
What an epic podcast chat with Rachel. And for me, it's conversations like this that light me up, really drive me with regards to my passion to this podcast show. It's honestly career journeys like this. I really do hope you learn a lot as much as I did. Like, I've had the privilege of moderating a session on the Legacy program, the 2022 of the Euros, but to actually dig deep of this sports career journey, it was such a privilege. And for me, there's many learning lessons from this podcast chat, but there's two that stick out for me. One, the resilience piece, where Rachel was so open and honest how the deal didn't go through and how Kelly Simmons came in to provide that encouragement of not to, you know, quit and to keep going and what she's so passionate about. I think for me, it's a reminder that this is part of the football industry, sports industry, that not all deals go through. The key thing is how we learn from them. And I'm actually experiencing some of these situations, not at the highest level at a national league not going through, but at the end of the day, learning from failures is so, so important. And that's where the real growth happens. The second component, which is completely opposite, but it made me smile, is Rachel's involvement with all the World Cups. Even the mascot story, which was inspired by Alex Scott, which I read her book. As I said, please read that book. You'll get a really good understanding with regards to a player's perspective in the women's game. And to add that, this is where this is so magical, what I'm about to say. It was Tatiana Henine on the podcast who said, if you want to work in the football industry, understand the players' needs. And without a doubt, Rachel Pavlou knew that very early on when she was working during all those World Cups, making sure the family are happy, making sure the families are settled, even being the mascot maker, if people thought that was her main role. It shows the fun aspect that you should always have fun in the work you do, but always have passion in the change you're trying to create with the organisation you're working in or the change in society. And that is what I admire the most from people who've been growing the game for decades. And I really just want to put that out there because it motivates me with regards to my involvement at a very small level compared to the other pioneers who've literally grown the game to where it is today, certainly England perspective. So I really do hope you've enjoyed this podcast chat as much as I have. And from a career standpoint, I hope you can take some of the learning lessons from Rachel's career journey and apply it to your sports career journey now and make it happen. Now, as always, at the end of each podcast episode, I like to finish with an inspirational quote from my guest speaker. Rachel said, in any job, you've got to learn how to communicate effectively with people. You then got to learn how to work in a team. And then finally, you need to be organized. Those three skills will support your career growth and progression.